for argument is Jacqueline Barnhart versus Open Harvest Cooperative. Ms. Osborne, good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning. Abby Osborne from Schiffer Miller Law Office this morning. May it please the court, counsel, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In this case, the trial court erred in determining that the appellee was entitled to summary judgment on the appellant's ERISA claim. The trial court primarily erred in restricting the analysis, stating that the appellant must show that the termination was the interfering event, and restricting the analysis strictly to the termination question and not expanding the analysis to other incidents of interference in order for the appellant to succeed on her interference claim. The undisputed evidence is that the appellee terminated the appellant's coverage effective 2 days prior to her termination. The insurance company's denial explicitly stated that coverages were terminated by the employer on July 31st, 2011, and the appellant wasn't terminated until August 2nd of 2011. This is further conceded in the appellee's brief on page 14, where it indicates that Nygren was advised to terminate the coverage. So there is what I would argue is direct evidence that the appellee did, in fact, interfere with the appellant's benefit coverage by terminating it, and terminating it effective 2 days prior to her termination. The district court, I argue, erred in finding that that was not direct evidence. But if this court also concludes that it's not direct evidence, I argue that it's at least sufficient evidence that a reasonable juror, especially if the facts are taken in light of the non-moving party, as they're supposed to be, could conclude that the appellant has at least satisfied the first part of the burden-shifting analysis, and concluding that there's at least sufficient evidence that a reasonable jury could conclude that there was intent of the appellant, of the appellee business to interfere with my client's benefits. The trial court additionally erred in perhaps their understanding of determining whether or not the appellant would have been entitled to the benefits, and the primary statement of that in the order indicates that the appellant would not have been entitled to her benefits because she did not apply until September following her termination. But at the time when she became disabled, the disability date being August 2nd, 2011, as found by the insurance company, she should have still had premiums paid for her because those amounts were deducted from her final paycheck in order to be paid to the company, and she should have still been covered at the time of her termination, but for the appellee's act of terminating her coverage effective 2 days prior to her termination. Additionally, the appellee has argued that the policy would dictate that the appellant was not eligible for her benefits at the time of her termination. And in order to make this argument, there has to be some sort of funny accounting where it just oddly works out and what ultimately would create a loophole if it's upheld, that an employer can avoid liability for an interference claim if they can coordinate with the policy language. And again, I argue that the policy language, as argued by the appellee, is evaluated incorrectly, but that if you can find a portion of your policy, in this case, terminating somebody shortly after the change in the calendar month when it immediately follows a weekend, so that they don't have an opportunity to work a full work week when their coverage otherwise would have been in place, and terminating their coverage effective at the end of the month. That's the argument that has been made in this case. I think that upholding that argument creates this loophole and an opportunity to evade liability under an ERISA claim. And I think to the extent that the court were to view whether or not she was covered by the policy based on that argument, or whether or not she still would have been covered, as I've argued, that's ultimately a question of fact and one for the fact finder to determine whether or not the policy or which way the policy was applied. It's not a black or white issue in this case, except for the extent that the insurance company did notify or indicate in their denial of her appeal of the termination that the benefits were denied because the appellant terminated the coverage. Excuse me, the employer terminated the coverage on July 31st, 2011. It was that termination of coverage by the employer and not the termination of the appellant from her employment that caused the denial of her benefits.
Well, under the plan terms, isn't she ineligible if she's no longer an employee?
The plan terms state that that your policy ends on the date your termination, the date your employment terminates, and then goes on to say cessation of active work will be deemed termination of employment, except if you are totally disabled and premiums continue to be paid when due. The date of disability is the date of the termination in this case, and the premiums were deducted from her final paycheck, yet they were not paid to the insurance company. So I think there's at least a valid argument that a fact finder could conclude with the evidence in this case that she would have been eligible under that portion of the policy. But the explicit language in the denial, although it doesn't reference this subsection 4 as opposed to subsection 5, the additional provision would be the subsection 4, the date you cancel your voluntary coverage. And I would argue a reasonable juror could conclude that the termination of the coverage by the employer falls under that provision and not under the alternative provision. I think that determining why her coverage was denied under that policy, again, is a factual question and not one of law, and therefore the summary judgment would be improper in determining that factor.
Well, if she could prove that she was disabled before the date she was terminated, wouldn't she have a claim then?
Well, that begs the question. If she could prove that she was terminated on August 1st, no, she wouldn't have a claim because she was terminated
prove she's disabled as of July 15th.
If she were disabled as of July 15th, it would be no question because the coverage was terminated on the 31st of July by the employer. That would have been perhaps a different question, whether or not it still would have been. It wouldn't have been the same interference question because the employer didn't terminate her coverage as of July 15th. They terminated her coverage as of July 31st, terminated her on the 2nd. So if she had become found to be disabled on August 1st as opposed to August 2nd, that's an easy question to answer. No, she wouldn't have been covered. Yes, she still would have been employed. The reasoning would have been that the employer terminated the coverage 2 days too early, or effective 2 days too early. The employer still deducted the amount, though, to pay for those premiums, yet didn't pay for them, although that was their obligation. So the interference, if you look at the date of disability, then, which requires the payment of the policy, she wasn't covered not because of the date, but because the employer failed to pay the premiums on the policy at that time. I think that there's at least sufficient
evidence. What did the district court say about that theory?
The district court essentially didn't address that theory.
Was that theory argued in the district court?
That theory was argued in the district court. The district court's analysis on this claim, and I've only appealed the one claim, essentially breaks down to she didn't apply until September when she found out the benefits were due, and so she was denied. I've argued that the district court essentially misunderstood the analysis regarding whether or not she would have been able to obtain her benefits. On September, when she applied, had she become disabled in September, then the question may have been different. But the date of disability is not disputed. It's August 2nd, 2011, per the accounting by the insurance company. It's not disputed by the appellee. And it's not disputed by the appellant.
So I thought what is your theory? Your theory is that the violation is that the employer deducted the cost of the insurance
the
and didn't
violation,
provide them?
It's a two-part argument, essentially, and I have not got to the second part. The first part is that the employer terminated the coverage effective prior to her termination in order to stop her from getting the benefits she would have been entitled to. That's the primary argument.
They terminated the coverage on July 31 before she was terminated on August 2nd?
Correct.
And their answer to that is that the...
Their response is...
The insurance company said that it wouldn't extend?
Well, no. Their response is, well, she wouldn't have been covered. The insurance company does not address, essentially, whether or not she would have been covered on August 2nd. The insurance company indicates that they explicitly indicates that they denied her coverage because her termination, her policy was terminated by the employer prior to her disability date. So at the time she became disabled, she was not covered by this coverage that she otherwise had as a benefit of her employment.
But I thought your theory was under Section 1140. That's the cause of action you're relying on, right?
Yes, for the interference.
It's unlawful to discharge an employee or a participant or beneficiary for exercising any right.
And I believe
so. I thought you were complaining about the discharge, but now you seem to be complaining about the termination of the benefits.
That goes to the second part. There's substantial case law that
Well, just before you go to the second part, how does that theory about terminating the benefits come under the statute?
Because there's case law that indicates that the language is whether or not the termination interferes or other incidents interfere with the claim. Are there actions taken to interfere with the claim? Those specific actions were taken, but I also argue that the termination or the timing of the termination additionally is interference with the claim. The evidence is that basically as of August 31st, 2011, the appellant's manager expected her resignation or expected to terminate the plaintiff. The appellant. There was no expectation that she would continue her employment following August 31st, 2011. And so the question then is to look at the timing and the reason for the termination and moving up her termination to August 1st as opposed to August 31st when she otherwise would have been terminated and otherwise would have been eligible for her benefits. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may do so, yes. Mr. How do you pronounce your name?
Falson.
Oh, I just like it written around. You may proceed, sir.
May it please the court. Your Honor, it's Mark Falson with the Rumble-Lepte Law Firm, appearing on behalf of Appley Open Harvest Cooperative. I would like to highlight some of the factual background in this case that appellant did not highlight, and after doing so, discuss the applicable standard from the circuit with respect to ERISA interference cases and how that should be analyzed in light of the arguments made by the appellant in her brief as well as today. Brief factual backdrop, Open Harvest is a member-owned cooperative providing organic and natural foods in Lincoln, Nebraska. The employee, appellant, was employed by Open Harvest from 1994 to 2011 as its outreach and membership director. She was clearly a member of management. Open Harvest did provide its employees with access to short-term and long-term disability coverage. However, it's critical to note the employees were 100% responsible for those premiums. Open Harvest had no, financial gain to terminate anyone's coverage for those benefits. The employee was fully responsible. In January of 2011, Kelsey Swanson, who was also a longtime Open Harvest employee, was named its new general manager. And shortly thereafter, she began to more effectively manage Open Harvest, which included a greater oversight of poor performing employees such as the appellant. From February through July of 2011, the appellant was repeatedly counseled and progressively disciplined for a myriad of performance problems. This is not disputed. On July 20th, 2011, the employee appellant was placed on probation for unsatisfactory work performance and was placed on a performance improvement plan. Now, one of the job responsibilities of the employee was to organize these cooperative discussion groups with co-op employees as well as members. And she finally started to do so after being placed on probation. And the first discussion group was to occur on the evening of Thursday, July 28th, 2011, at a co-worker's house. At this meeting, again, it is undisputed that the employee made several derogatory comments about Open Harvest management. She did so in the presence of subordinate employees. She subscribed to her supported positions taken by others that were adverse to management. After that meeting, she asked her coworker not to report this outside the room. She didn't want anyone to know because this coworker had told her she was deeply offended by the comment she had made about Open Harvest Management. Nevertheless, this coworker felt the duty of loyalty that she had to management. The following morning, Friday, July 29th, reported that to management, and the employee appellant in this case was brought in by Kelsey Swanson and questioned about that. The appellant did not deny making the comments. All she would respond when asked if she made these derogatory comments at the meeting, she would say, no comment. After this meeting, Ms. Swanson had made the decision to terminate the appellant. However, she did not effectuate that termination this Friday. And the reason why she was unable to do so is that she had a protocol that she always wanted her finance manager, Ms. Ko Nygren, in the room when she terminated, and Ms. Nygren didn't work Fridays. So they decided to do it the following Monday when she reported to work. The appellant called in sick to work on Monday, didn't show up. And when she showed up on Tuesday, August 2nd, she was promptly terminated upon arriving. Again, one of the elements, the critical element that the appellant has to establish in this case is specific intent on the part of the appellant. And that's clearly does not exist. Here are some factual items in the record that demonstrate what the intent of Open Harvest was. One, after they terminated the appellant, they paid her 2 weeks severance pay despite having no legal obligation to do so and not asking for any type of severance agreement or releases in return. Two, when the appellant applied for unemployment benefits, Open Harvest notified the Nebraska Workforce Development that, one, yes, she had engaged in misconduct, but they wanted her to get unemployment benefits. They didn't want to do her any harm. And finally, and this is probably the most critical piece of evidence in the records, page 77 of the appendix. Upon the termination of the employee, of any employee, obviously you have to notify a benefits manager as to what to do with the employee's benefits. And this represents an email sent by, again, the Open Harvest finance manager, Ko Nygren, on August 3rd, which simply says that Jackie Barnhart, the appellant, has terminated. It says on August 1st, which again was by error. Again, there's no dispute that the decision was made on Friday the 29th, but the decision was not effectuated until the morning of August 2nd. But as I'll get to in a minute, that's really not relevant. It says she was not covered under her health or dental plans. She was covered under short-term, long-term, and life. Do we continue this coverage for the month of August? I would like to, if possible. That's the intent of the employer. However, the benefits manager correctly informed Ms. Nygren that generally, again, they require active employment. So normally it would terminate August 1st. If due to an arrangement you will keep her on your books as an active employee through the month of August, then it could go through August 31st. So if she has a claim during August, it would be important that she would be an active employee. Let me know how you want to proceed. Ms. Nygren responded truthfully. She said, no, she will receive 2 weeks severance but will not be working. So I guess we need to terminate her enrollment. Thanks. Essentially, the import of the position adopted by the appellant in this case is they wanted Open Harvest to be dishonest in their response to the benefits manager.
What's this business about the disability benefits terminating on July 31? That seemed to be the whole thrust of the argument this morning.
Right, and I frankly don't understand it. Again, bear in mind that the appellant didn't make a claim.
Well, what do you mean you don't? Slow down. Yeah. It's sort of complicated factually. So yes. Can you just explain whether the benefits were terminated July 31, and if so, how?
Yeah. All we know, we being Open Harvest know, is that we informed our benefits manager that she was terminated on August 1st, and in the documents that we submitted to Dearborn National, which is page 224 of the appendix, reflected in there accurately that her last day of work was August 2nd, 2011. In response, the following page in the appendix, 225, is the response that we received from Dearborn National. Dearborn National is the party, the entity that made the decision regarding coverage. And Dearborn National said that they completed the review of the claim. They quoted the language from the policy that says the date your employment terminates. It says benefits on this claim are denied as it was determined that the claim is excluded on the above reference policy provision. That's all we know. But it is our position that it matters not whether it was terminated July 31st or August 1st or August 2nd because the claimant didn't make a claim for benefits until September 15th. So again, we believe that this is a misdirection as to what the ultimate issue is whether, because initially it was our belief that the appellant was contending that she was wrongfully discharged as a way to interfere with ERISA claims. But we hear, I guess, here today that this really isn't a wrongful termination case, that that's not her contention.
Well, it's both, she says, but okay. Her brief does say... go ahead.
Okay. Well, irrespective of which theory the appellant is now proceeding under, the district court noted that since the employee did not file a claim for short-term disability benefits until a month and a half after termination, there was no evidence that the employee exercised any right under the plan prior to her separation, and thus it wasn't a retaliation case. So they analyze it strictly as an interference case. And under the interference precedent in the circuit, the appellant had an obligation, the burden, to establish a specific intent on the part of Open Harvest to interfere with employees' benefits. This she did not do. She didn't even establish a prima facie case. Again, page 77, the email that I mentioned in reference to, that clearly indicates an intent on the part of Open Harvest to get benefits, to obtain benefits for the appellant. What Dearborn National eventually decided is really between Dearborn National and the employee. But unfortunately, the employee did not pursue an action against Dearborn National. These cases, when there is no direct evidence, are analyzed under the McDonnell-Douglas tripartite burden-shifting scheme.
Does this policy work that the benefits are provided only on a month-to-month basis so that either they would terminate on July 31 or August 31? Is that why this July 31 date comes in?
Your Honor, I don't know. Open Harvest wasn't in the position of interpreting this policy. Open Harvest simply accurately reported its information to Dearborn National, which made the decision to deny the appellant her benefits. That decision was not made by Open Harvest. All the documentation submitted by my client, Open Harvest, was accurate. I suggest that the appellant perhaps has pursued the wrong party in this particular claim. In order to
I'm trying to remember. Did Ms. Barnhart have a long-standing medical condition?
She did. She had, I believe it was an arterial malformation,
right.
Correct.
So her claim existed, I assume, on the day before her discharge.
And existed perhaps 10 years before that. I mean, again, it's not disputed that the appellant had medical problems. But we would contend that it's also not disputed that there are well-documented performance problems under a new manager who, under the precedent of this circuit and other circuits, new supervisors or different supervisors may impose different standards of conduct or their expectations of employees. What she had was new management.
And you say that she has not pursued a wrongful discharge claim or not?
Well, I believe in this case she did. She brought her initial complaint, brought four theories of recovery,
sure.
And all were a subject to summary judgment.
Mm. Well, when this form that went to Dearborn came from your client, right? The one that says that Barnhart has been terminated. Your client sent a form into Dearborn National.
Right. One example of it, it's in here multiple times, would be page 224 in the appendix.
And it says that premiums were paid through July 31.
Yes, correct.
So isn't that why the insurance provider said that's when the coverage ends? Because that's when the premium...
But she was no longer actively employed. The last day in which she was actively employed was the last day she actually worked, which was, again...
August 2nd, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, did she perform her work on it? That's the latest it could be. So, again, it doesn't matter...
It says last day worked 8/2/11 on what client submitted to the insurance company.
And giving the appellant the benefit of the doubt that is the date, remains our contention. One, it doesn't matter because that was the date coverage would have terminated under the policy language. And two, it's not Open Harvest's obligation to determine whether coverage exists. It is the appellant's burden to show that there was a specific intent on the part of Open Harvest to terminate her so as to prevent her from gaining this coverage. And there's nothing in the record to demonstrate that. The evidence, on the other hand, demonstrates the contrary. They were trying to get her benefits. They tried to get her unemployment benefits. They paid her severance despite not having any legal obligation to do so. Again, there was no monetary incentive for Open Harvest to not provide her with this coverage. Open Harvest wasn't paying anything for this coverage. The employee was fully responsible. Again, Open Harvest truthfully responded to Dearborn National. Assuming argument.
Well, what about the business about the premiums? Apparently, you did. She did pay premiums through August 15, but
correct. It was inadvertently.
So you didn't respond truthfully when you said 7/31/11 was the date through which premiums were paid. That was error.
I respectfully disagree with Your Honor's characterization of it. Truthfully, I think what may
have
happened.
You just said we gave truthful. You used the word truthful.
Right. Okay. Essentially, what I believe happened is that when she received her final paycheck, that had been deducted, and that may have occurred at some point. It was an oversight. It certainly wasn't intentional. And bear in mind, there's no evidence in the record to establish that there was any intent on the part of Open Harvest to deny her benefits.
Or as a matter of fact, would there have been any financial advantage to Open Harvest to have denied her benefit?
Absolutely
not.
In terms of their
history, I don't know how these ERISA ratings go with the company.
No, absolutely.
Is it like an auto company? You have too many losses and you don't get good coverage anymore?
No, absolutely no financial incentive for Open Harvest to deny this coverage, as this court has previously held in the Register versus Honeywell case. Again, that is one of the elements which may suggest that there's intent. If the company has a financial incentive to deny coverage, that doesn't exist in this case.
What happened to the money that was deducted?
It was returned to her.
Returned.
Yeah, I believe after it was discovered in September or October, it was returned to her.
And that was deducted from the severance pay portion?
Again, I'm not sure that's in the record. That's my belief, Your Honor. Again, appellant took no depositions in this case. We have the plaintiff's deposition, and we have the other documentary evidence, which was submitted for summary judgment.
But your understanding is that if the information given to Dearborn had said she paid premiums through August 15. Dearborn is saying she can only be covered through August 2nd.
That is correct.
Or August 1st, whatever the date.
That is correct. And even if she was covered through August 30th, it would be our contention that she did not file a claim until September 15th, and therefore would not. She is not in the protected class for purposes of this claim and cannot establish a prima facie case. Again, that is in holding with the Manning case from 2010, in which there is no prima facie case if the claimant can't establish that she is eligible under the particular policy.
Once more, back to the lack of intent, or is there any suggestion by plaintiff that she was somehow blindsided through this prompt or quick unexpected termination?
I believe she contends that the record demonstrates entirely otherwise. Again, with new management, they started to turn things around.
Okay.
I see that I'm out of time. On behalf of Open Harvest, we respectfully request that the district court's granting of summary judgment in this case be affirmed.
Ms. Osborne?
Thank you. To answer your question regarding whether or not the claimant was blindsided by her termination. No, she was not blindsided by the ultimate.
That's probably a poor choice of words in my part, but go on.
Well, I think it's an appropriate question to ask, though. The writing was on the wall. She was going to be terminated. The claims brought were that it was a wrongful termination in connection to the ERISA claim and as well. The writing was on the wall. She was going to end her employment either by a forced resignation or by a termination on August 31st. She was blindsided by the timing of being terminated on August 2nd. And the record, basically, with regards to the wrongful termination question, because I know I've left that somewhat unexplained, the timing of the termination is what ultimately supports the wrongful discharge portion or what provides the inference in the claimant's favor on the wrongful discharge portion of this. And it was incorrectly stated that she had just had recorded performance deficiencies only by other management. The same manager, Ms. Swanson, gave her a satisfactory rating and a 3% increase prior to her disclosure of her medical condition at the beginning of 2011. And she did indicate there were things she needed to work on, but gave her a satisfactory rating and a raise prior to her disclosure of her disability, her serious health condition, this AVM. Following that, Swanson began to discipline her for things that other people were not disciplined for. The record indicates that. It called her emails where she suggested that she'd like to collaborate with coworkers, rude and unprofessional. Ultimately, as the timeline goes on here through 2011, Swanson becomes aware of the fact that the claimant now has health insurance through her husband, so she can afford the treatment that she wants to have because of her condition. She's telling other management at Open Harvest that she's going to have this. It becomes more imminent that she's going to have this treatment done as Swanson tightens her vice on the appellant, either to force her to resign or to put, as it's contested through the motion to strike, a dog and pony show, as she refers to it, in order to be able to cleanly terminate her on August 31st or force her resignation. What occurred wasn't several derogatory comments at this discussion meeting. Your Honor, I'd like to finish my comment.
You may complete your statement. Yeah.
But rather, the evidence there shows that she indicated it would not be permitted to be a gripe session. She indicated that Swanson came from a corporate background, and the example of a corporation that she used was the 108th Forbes 500 company at that time, be it McDonald's. And Swanson found that to be the type of misconduct that warranted her termination. Apparently, the decision was made on the same day that the appellant notified her that she wanted to discuss her impending leave and what sort of benefits were available to her. I believe there's sufficient evidence to support all of the prima facie case, as well as the pretext issue, and that the judgment should be reversed.
Did Open Harvest have any incentive to deny her these benefits?
They had no incentive to deny her the benefits, which I contend supports a finding of at least a pretext or goes to the intent issue, that they could have and ultimately should have paid the premiums, which they deducted to her, and let the insurance company decide whether or not she was actively working.
If they had paid through August 31st and the claims made on September 15th, would there be coverage?
Yes, there would be coverage because of her disability date occurred during the time when she would have been covered.
What was the disability date?
August 2nd is what the insurance company determined the disability date to be, and that's included in the evidence. I'm sorry, I can't give you a specific cite to that. But the appellee argued that it was their contention that they determined she was not actively employed. They took the step of denying her that and making that determination on their own rather than letting the insurance company determine that she was not actively employed if that was the case. I think there's sufficient evidence in light of the appellant that summary judgment is improper.
Very well. The case is submitted. We thank both sides for the argument, and we'll take the case under consideration. We'll be in recess for about 10 minutes.